Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Good evening, Liam. How you doing?
Good, thanks, Matt. How you going?
I'm good. You're excited for your upcoming travels, I guess. Are you finding it hard to concentrate, or are you keeping your nose to the grindstone and just letting that one come in due course?
Work's getting busy. Like, there's deadlines that we need to hit. So, yeah, it's knowing that I've only got today, tomorrow to finish off what I need to finish off makes it a bit more stressful. But having a week off is going to be good. I need a bit more of a break, you know, school holidays though. So it's either at home with the kids or we go away with the kids.
Nice. Are they excited?
Absolutely. They're always keen for a good break.
How's the anxiety about taking time off? Is this your first time taking time off as a business owner?
Yes, as a business owner. No, not as a contractor. What I learned from previously doing contracting is the way I internally structure the paying myself, right? So I pay myself separately to the business getting paid, or my, even as a contractor, myself getting paid as a contractor. Right. So I would build a buffer externally to what I see, well, what we see as a family drip feeding in each week, each fortnight, so that when I do take time off or if I get sick, there's a buffer there that it keeps coming in. So the family don't see a difference in the pay.
Yeah, just the business.
As the business or the entity itself, prior to setting up a business, the entity itself, build that buffer up. But, you know, as I start to scale, I'm sure I'll have a lot more challenges about taking time off. Right now, with a smaller subset of clients under my belt, it's relatively straightforward to be taking that time.
Have you read The E-Myth or The E-Myth Revisited?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, I've come across them. I haven't read them. And I, to be honest, I don't know too much about the content or the bulk of what it's meant to be.
Okay. Well, I highly recommend them. You should definitely read them. So The E-Myth Revisited was like the kind of basically the second edition. So you can just read that. It's kind of the golden rule about running a business is making the business not be dependent on you being there or you as an individual. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's nothing new, but it's a good book. And we're getting a bit off topic here, but on the subject of books, I need to make a correction about our last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Just a minor one. So I mentioned about some meeting strategies that I'd heard about, the designated asshole and not allowing a senior idea pitcher into a meeting where that idea is being discussed. And I mistakenly thought that they were from the book A Whole New Mind by Dan Pink. They're actually not from that book at all. They're from possibly my favorite book of all time, one of my favorite books of all time, which is You Are Not So Smart by David McCraney.
I remember a couple of years back you recommending that to me. So I picked it up and had to read myself.
Yeah.
And I think there's a good episode, I think, based on this book that we can do down the track.
I think so too. I think let's do it. Let's put it on the backlog.
I need to take this away with me on holidays for now and actually get through it so I can have something meaningful to talk about.
Yeah. I reread it every year or two. I just think it's that useful.
So if we're not going to be talking about that book tonight, what would you like to discuss?
Well, there's a lot of topical things going on at the moment, and there's something that's a bit less topical now than it was a few weeks ago when I first thought about talking about this,
mm-hmm.
but it's annoying me again today, so I want to talk about it, and that is Netflix. So, Liam, let me ask you a question. Do you have a Netflix subscription?
Not at the moment.
No?
No. There are so many streaming services out there.
Yeah.
We have to pick and choose which ones we're going to subscribe to at any point in time, and at the moment, well, we got through a point where we basically went through all the content on Netflix that appealed to us. Myself, my wife, we have completely different tastes. Rarely can we sit down and find something that we both want to watch. We got through that small subset of things that we both wanted to watch, so we went to look at other ones. So at the moment we're currently subscribed to Stan, contemplating whether or not it's time to shift back now to Netflix.
Interesting. I also don't currently have a Netflix subscription, and we also do what you do, which is we pick and choose which service we want to subscribe to based on what we want to watch. And we also kind of tend to wait for a build-up of a few things, and then we'll subscribe for a month and then get through that and then switch to something else.
Yep.
It wasn't always like this, right? And I want to go back. Let's go back a few years. When Netflix launched, they weren't a streaming service. They were actually a DVD rental by mail service. I don't know if you remember this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, not here in Australia, but, you know, everything I've read and read about the history, yes.
Yeah. So there actually was a competing service that was set up here in Australia. I can't remember what they were called. They didn't last very long. Oh, I wish I could remember what they were called. I'm just going to look it up quickly. I can't remember what they were called. They had an office in North Sydney, and they were called, I think they were called QuickFlix.
That name rings a bell.
Quick, yeah. They were called QuickFlix. Okay.
Yep.
And they were founded in 2003 in Perth.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their headquarters in North Parramatta. And they did what Netflix were doing. They thought this was a great idea. Let's ship these DVDs around to people by mail. And then they jumped on the streaming bandwagon when that became a thing. And then they shut up shop in 2021. So 3 years ago. And they were a long dead horse by that point, no doubt. And it's a shame because I actually subscribed for a while. In fact, I got a free trial. And then during this free trial, I watched all of the streaming content they had that was remotely of interest to me. I saw a random obscure movie about some time travel alien invasion in a pub thing. It was really weird and terrible, but really enjoyable in a strange kind of way. I can't remember what it's called. And then the trial ended and I'd already finished everything. And they asked me if I wanted to continue my subscription. And I said no. And they said why. I said, well, you know, I've watched everything that you've got. And they said, well, you know, we've got all this DVD stuff. And I said, yeah, but I'm not interested in that. I want the streaming.
Yeah.
You know, let me know when you've added more content and I'll subscribe again. And they never did. Anyway, that's off topic. But it is interesting that was kind of the model. And then, of course, Netflix really pioneered streaming.
Mm-hmm.
Not the technology. So streaming, you know, where video streaming technology was pioneered and where all of the innovation into that has come from?
Gaming?
No.
Was it gaming? No, that was chat, wasn't it? IM was come from gaming, I think. Oh, sorry, one of the major services came from a gaming chat. I can't remember what it was.
Discord?
Discord, maybe? I can't remember. Anyway, sorry, let's rewind that a bit. No, sorry, Matt, I don't know where streaming came from.
I mean, obviously streaming has been around for a long time, but the big technological advances in streaming technology have come from the porn industry.
The porn industry's been the innovator across the board, hasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Traditionally, anecdotally, that's the reason why VHS won over Beta, where DVD won over whatever the competing technology at the time was.
Right.
Supposedly.
Right. Yeah, I didn't know that little bit of history, but you're right that a lot of major innovations come out of porn, and streaming in particular was one. So a lot of the technology that we take for granted now in video streaming was kind of pioneered and innovated by the porn industry. But anyway, so Netflix, you know, they didn't necessarily pioneer the technology, but they pioneered the business model of delivering content mm-hmm. to people via streaming. Now, at the time, there was a real problem for consumers, right? And that was that your choice was frankly shit, right? Because your choice of receiving content was either free over the air, renting DVDs or videos, or you could get a cable or satellite subscription.
Sorry, you're missing one more. Pirating.
Pirating. I'm really glad you raised that because I'm going to circle back to that point shortly, right? And I'm going to circle back to it, and then I'm going to circle back to it again later, okay? So putting aside pirating for the moment, if you wanted to legally and legitimately consume video, you know, television and movie content, your choices were free to air, renting or buying DVDs, or a cable or satellite subscription. So mm-hmm. in the UK, we had a major company called Sky, who were the satellite mm-hmm. provider. Here in Australia, we've got Foxtel.
And before you arrived here, we had Optus Vision too.
Really?
Yeah. So there were I think there was actually three early on, and then Foxtel basically muscled everyone out.
Was Optus Vision cable?
Yes. Optus was cable, Foxtel was cable, and there was a third one. I think it could have been called Galaxy, and that was satellite.
Foxtel's satellite as well, though, isn't it?
A bit of both now.
Right, right.
Right. So if the cable's not sufficient, then they can do, then there's the dishes too. But from memory, I can't remember which one it was too. Also had microwaves.
Right. Okay.
So you'd have a receiver on your roof that pointed to, and I believe it was Sydney Tower, where they would broadcast right. the signal via microwave from there.
That's interesting. We actually had a microwave wireless site-to-site link connecting two offices in a what's called a MAN, I guess, a metropolitan area network in a previous company of mine. Anyway, that's a tangent.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the business model, right? So if you wanted cable or satellite, you would look at the brochure, I guess, or the website, and you would say, wow, there's like, what, 100, 200 channels here. And of those, there's maybe six that are good that I'm interested in. So there's probably maybe two movie channels. There's the action movie channel and there's the kids movie channel. There's whichever of the sport channels, maybe even two or three of the sport channels that you're interested in. There's like some daytime TV or drama or what have you. And then, you know, the kids, the regular kids channel and probably the 24-hour news or what have you. But of course, each one of these was in a different package. You know, they would offer 12 different packages, each one of them with one of the channels that everyone wanted, or the deluxe package where you pay through the nose and you get everything.
Yep.
So when Netflix started offering streaming, and by the way, this wasn't unique to Foxtel or Sky, that's the model for cable and satellite providers the world over. Like, that is the business model. They know damn well exactly what content people want and what combinations of people want. And they split the things people want into different packages. So that,
yeah, of course,
you either buy multiple packages or you buy the deluxe that gives you everything. That's business, right? So when Netflix came along, they were a disruptor. And Netflix were a major threat. I mean, you know, now we take Netflix for granted now. They're one among many now. But, you know, you think back to 10 years ago, not even 10, you know, 10 years ago for sure, Netflix were a disruptor and they were a major threat to, you know, I guess, Hollywood, the television production companies and the major distribution channels like satellite and cable providers.
Yep.
Now, mostly they were a threat to the distribution channels because they offered actually an extra revenue stream to the content creators. Because think about it this way, you're a TV studio, you're a movie studio, you create a movie, you get some, let's focus on movies for now, right? So you make a movie, you spend a couple of hundred mil on it, whatever. Nowadays, it's a, you know, that much at least. But let's say you spend $50 million making a movie, plus another $100 million promoting it globally. And then you get some box office takings. So everyone talks about opening weekend. So you get a bunch of money in the box office, and then you get a bit more money in the global box office. And then you get a bit of money in the DVD sales. And then you get an exponentially diminishing return on that investment over time through future DVD sales, royalties through broadcast. So if, you know, a year later, a few TV channels around the world add it to their Christmas blockbuster lineup, but the returns are exponentially diminishing, right? So Netflix come along and say, you know, we'll host this for you digitally. It's not going to cost you anything. You just let us do it. And every time someone watches it, we'll give you some money. Now, I'm not 100% sure whether that was the actual model or whether they said, you know, I don't know what contracts Netflix negotiated with these studios or whoever. It may have been, we'll pay you a nominal fee and in exchange, you'll let us have this catalog of movies. It may have been, we'll pay you per view, whatever. The details are not important. What's important is that for the content creators, as in the movie studios, and of course the TV studios, but this example I'm focusing on movies, it's an extra revenue stream for them for nothing, right? They don't have the expense of paying for the DVDs to be printed, the, you know, the boxes, the cover art, the distribution, the shipping. They don't have any of that overhead. They literally had someone come along and say, we'll give you money for nothing, right? For this IP, this content that you have, it's a sunk cost for you. You've already spent the money on it. We're going to give you more money by letting us show this to our subscribers. So it's, you know, mutually beneficial. We add content to our catalog. People want our catalog. And in return, you get money for something that you basically, you know, written down at this point. So it's a win-win, apart from the traditional incumbent distributors like the cable and satellite companies. Now, given my earlier comments on business model and splitting the most desirable content into different packages, you can probably imagine that I'm sitting here playing the world's smallest violin about them losing out.
Yes.
And for a while, things were great, right? So Netflix was adding extra revenue to these studios and these content creators. Consumers were loving it. It was a very, very small monthly fee. Me, as someone who has never had a cable or satellite subscription, my dad did when I was a kid for a while. My dad had it, but other than that, never had it. I've never, certainly never been something I've paid for myself. And then Netflix came along and I looked at it and I thought, do you know what? $15 a month, that's Aussie, right? So in the US, it was like seven, eight, 10, I don't know. But $15 a month for basically unlimited access to this streaming catalog, I was like, yeah, I'll just pay that. And not only did I think that, but I'll circle back to your earlier comment as well. You know, clearly millions upon millions of people also thought that, because millions upon millions of people signed up for Netflix and they blew up. Yeah. But not only that, piracy numbers dropped.
Absolutely. So one thing I remember around that time, and I don't know if you were here in Australia at the time, but the record, well, particularly in the music industry, but also the TV video industry, right? The production companies took the telcos to court saying that they're providing the mechanisms for people to download illegally. No, always remember iiNet, who at the time would have been, I think, the fourth largest ISP in Australia. Now they're owned by TPG, so I think they're pushing second or third. Their lawyers went, you know, they were in there and they're basically just saying, well, we can't be held to blame here, right? We're just the channel yeah. everyone's using. And then the production companies, you know, they're sitting there crying and they're just, how do we compete with free?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I always remember the iiNet lawyers just walked in and basically said two words, bottled water, right?
That's a mic drop moment.
Exactly. That's it. It's, you can get water for free, or effectively it's free out of the tap.
Yeah.
But yet people still pay $15 for a bottle of water.
Yeah.
People will still spend money on water that they can get for free out of a tap. And this is your point just here. If you make it convenient for people and cheap enough, or convenient and at the right price and enticing yeah. enough, people will pay. People
That's absolutely
don't
right.
want to be streaming. People don't want to be pirating. They don't want to do the illegal thing. They want the convenient thing. Anyway, sorry, that's a bit of an aside of that basic, that time of...
It's not an aside. It's a very, very pertinent point. And it's exactly the point. And this is the thing, and numerous studies, and in fact, we will talk about this when we do our next talk about that book, You're Not So Smart, because this comes up in that book. People have a very acute sense of fairness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Netflix came along with their business model. It was convenient. It was cheap. But it was also... I think people felt compelled to actually give them their money out of spite towards, you know, the cable and the satellite companies, who had clearly been, like, you know, Netflix coming along and disrupting them. They weren't disrupting the perception that these other companies have been fleecing people. I don't think anyone has been under any illusions about the business model of the cable and satellite companies. Like, people have known for decades. Like, when I was a kid and I was looking at the packages with my dad in the brochure, and he was sort of saying, oh, which one should I get? You know, we were looking at it and saying, well, we want this channel, and this channel. Yeah. It's like, well, then we have to either get three packages or we have to get the deluxe that gives us everything.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't need Netflix to come along and offer an alternative for us to know that that was, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to say corrupt, because it's not corrupt, but it's taking advantage of the situation. They're taking advantage of the engineered monopoly, really. So I think when Netflix came along, yes, people will pay for bottled water, and people would, you know, there's obviously still people out there that pirate content and would like to pirate content and not pay money.
Hmm.
But I think there's also, especially here in Australia, a contingent of people that wanted content at a reasonable price and at a reasonable time, and were happy to pay for it. Because the other problem that we had here in Australia is that we wouldn't get things for months after they'd come out elsewhere. Yep. Now, if you think back to around this time, which was when Game of Thrones was at its peak, people in Australia did not want to wait months for the next season of Game of Thrones, especially when everyone's talking about it online and you're going to have spoilers.
Yep.
And I think at that time, Game of Thrones was in fact on Netflix. It's not now. It's on Binge now in Australia. By the way, Binge is owned by Foxtel.
Yep.
I don't know if you knew that. So people have an acute sense of fairness. People are happy to pay for something if it's reasonable. Also, you know, a lot of people probably don't want the risk of pirating.
No.
But I think a lot of people did it because something either wasn't available at a reasonable price, or wasn't available at a reasonable time.
Yep.
And using Game of Thrones as an example again, I'll have to fact check this because I'm going from memory here, but I'm pretty sure Game of Thrones is the most pirated content in history.
Mm.
And the other thing that's interesting as well, getting back to Australia in particular, we've spoken about this before in other industries, right? And we actually may have spoken about this example as well. So Netflix comes along, and of course, they're at this point a major disruptor and a major threat to what is at this time a monopoly here for the distribution channel mm-hmm. in Australia, which is Foxtel, which is owned by, our survey says, Rupert Murdoch.
Yep.
And Netflix, any disruptor comes along and says, look, here's a better way of doing something. We're now doing something in a way that is less expensive, better for us as a business, better for your customers. everyone wins, do it this way or lose out. Now, of course, the Australian government, no, let's not go down, let's not open that rabbit hole. The incumbents here said, no, we're not going to adapt. We're not going to work the way that things now work in the world. We're just going to block it. So there was a large effort to basically have streaming blocked in Australia.
Yes, I think knowing, because I've had a bit of commercial experience in the media industry at one of the large broadcasters here in Australia, and I'm not 100% sure, but a lot of the licensing of what we see on TV is dictated by the license holders, by the production companies. What you see on, argument's sake again, free-to-air, because that's my experience in the past, when they purchase the licenses to show a movie on TV, they will purchase, say, 3 viewings or 5 viewings. You're only allowed to show it 3-5 times or whatever they've purchased, right? They don't get an open options to just put it on whenever they want. They have to track how many times they've put it to air, and they're paying based on their licensing. And I do believe back then too, and I'm pretty sure it'd be similar now, there is different licensing based on distribution medias too. So the licensing, and yes, it would be the broadcast companies as well who are protecting their own turf, right? For argument's sake, one of the broadcasters might have purchased the broadcast licenses for Game of Thrones in Australia, but they didn't purchase the streaming licenses for Game of Thrones. It's not necessarily the streaming that they're against. It's the fact that the licensing for that content was not licensed to be streamed. And it was the license owners and like the broadcast partners who owned the license to broadcasting were there. They were also jumping up and down saying, well, we're paid through the nose for this to be allowed to broadcast it. You shouldn't be allowed to stream it in our territory because we own that Australian territory, basically.
Yes. So hence the delay, right?
I was going to say, and that's why back then when Netflix was really kicking off, there was basically no content available in Australia and a lot of people would have to get a VPN.
So that was going to be where I was going to go next with this story. Yeah.
Yep.
So, and that's when the next thing happened. Now, before I get into that, I just want to draw a parallel to this discussion because it's not uncommon here in Australia. This is kind of how things have been working here for a long time. But the other parallel to this is retail. So I don't know if you remember, but maybe 10 years ago, led by Harvey Norman, but also, you know, some of the other major retailers here as well, there was a lot of pressure on the government to impose an arbitrary tax on anything purchased on eBay or Amazon.
Yes.
Purely to make those prices less competitive.
Yes.
You know, again, it's like, well, okay, the market is changing, the industry is changing, the world is changing. We could adapt and we could become more competitive. Let's not do that. Let's block the competition. And you know, the problem with that mentality is not just that it's obviously anti-progressive, and but I feel that through probably about 2 decades of successful lobbying, Australia has fallen behind the world in a number of ways. And I think compared to, say, the 1990s, when Australia was absolutely a pioneer and leading the world in a number of areas, like, for example, being one of, unless I'm mistaken, you know, if not the first country to ban incandescent light bulbs.
Possible.
That happened here first.
Yep.
You know, again, like thinking back to the 1990s and thinking of Australia as a competitive country, and then looking forward from there and thinking about our internet connection, right? Yeah. We're laughing because our NBN is a joke. And it's, unfortunately, it was a fantastic idea to make us competitive on the global scale by having a national broadband network and making sure that everyone in Australia was connected to the internet with a fast, reliable service. And it's just been used as a political weapon that's been fired back and forth, you know, across the bench for years and years and years, and is now, you know, sadly a bit of a joke. And unfortunately, what's happened with the NBN is it has exacerbated specifically the problem it was designed to solve, which was that some people would have fantastic internet and others would have terrible internet. And now that is what we have exactly now with the NBN. And you compare that to, for example, South Korea, which have, I don't know the exact date, but it was definitely before 2010. When they had 150 megabit internet rolled out to every home in the country.
Yeah. And I think to loop this back to the topic at hand, when the NBN was really launching here in Australia, was around the same time that Netflix was taking off.
Yes.
Right. So there was a lot more contention on the NBN connections, and where you were purchasing a 24 megabit connection, you were actually only getting during peak times a 10 megabit connection, because everyone on the street was streaming Netflix.
Yeah. So back to Netflix, right? So at this specific time, as you mentioned, you know, everyone started getting a VPN. I don't know if you remember that there was a service called Getflix. Did you hear about this? It was very cheap. It was like $1 a month or something like that. Maybe, but it was very, very inexpensive. And it was basically a DNS server.
Mm.
You would set your DNS to use Getflix's DNS instead of, you know, whatever your default DNS provider is, or Google or whatever. So it wasn't actually a VPN. It was just a DNS server. And I guess the way that it worked was that when you queried the Netflix endpoints, instead of giving you what was resolved locally, it gives you whatever the endpoints are in the US or UK or whatever you set it to. So Netflix, you know, this went on for a while. And Netflix, they didn't really care, because people were paying and getting the content they wanted. But of course, as you mentioned, it's all dictated by the license holders, and they did care.
Yep.
So it wasn't quick. It took like a couple of years. But Netflix shut it down, first with some what appeared to be perfunctory changes, and eventually they blocked it. So some people kind of persisted and it made things work in other ways, like with an actual VPN. But yeah, so I have to say I used it, and it was like walking into Aladdin's cave. When I exhausted my Aussie content and switched on this, you know, switched to US or UK, and it just opened this like cavernous supply of all this amazing content. It was awesome. So the next thing that Netflix did, which they also turned a blind eye to for years and years and years, was subscription sharing.
Mm-hmm.
This was a big problem. And this was a problem for them as well, not just their suppliers, not just the providers and the content creators. People would share passwords and, you know, split the bill for a Netflix subscription.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't really care. They did some stuff. They spoke for a long time about shutting it down. And eventually they clamped down on it. So it's very difficult to do that now with Netflix, if not impossible. So Netflix has basically gone from being this awesome service that just kind of worked, was very easy to pay for because it was a very small amount of money for a very large amount of value. And a lot of that has been eroded away. But that's not the biggest problem. The biggest problem with Netflix today, well, we've mentioned Stan, we've mentioned Binge, but the problem is the value proposition was you pay one small fee and you get access to a bunch of streaming content. That was a great deal.
Mm.
And I would even potentially argue that Netflix was a beneficial monopoly. So the fact that Netflix was a monopoly was actually a large part of the value that it offered. But then they did something unthinkable, right? And what they did was they started creating Netflix original content. Now, this might seem like a really smart strategic decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's called vertical integration. So Apple have done it. You know, Apple now control the production and manufacture of all of their chips. They use their own chips. They switch from Intel to Apple Silicon. They control the full supply chain. They actually started this off with iPhones. So with the A10 or, you know, now 17 chips or whatever they are in the iPhones. So they used to source ARM chips, and then they started designing and manufacturing their own, and then they moved that across to their Mac line, and it's worked out really well for them. So they control the whole supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
And on paper, you know, it's a smart decision. It can be very strategic. But when Netflix did it, it was a massive conflict of interest, because the value that Netflix offered to their customers, it wasn't the distribution. Like the distribution and streaming and at a low price and always on and on demand and all that, that was great, but the actual value is in the content, right? And the content came from their suppliers.
Absolutely.
And their content providers. Mm-hmm. So when Netflix started creating Netflix original content, some of which, by the way, has been absolutely bloody fantastic. Like some of it has been really, really good. But the problem is Netflix, when they started doing that, started competing with their partners and their suppliers.
And is that when we start seeing the likes of Paramount Plus and Disney Plus and...
Exactly. Yeah.
Yep.
And frankly, it's not unreasonable for Paramount, Disney, whoever else to say, well, you know, why should we sell our content to them and let them compete with us for content as well? Why don't we compete with them for distribution?
Yep.
So mixing supply and distribution is a mixed bag, right? So it can be a very strategic decision, or it can be the cardinal sin, right? And in Netflix's case, it was the cardinal sin. I'm not saying that Netflix is going under as a business, but I did the numbers today, right? So I got a little spreadsheet here.
Yep.
And this is a small snapshot, a small cross-section, right? 10 years ago, I was happy to pay $15 a month for Netflix. Mm-hmm. Now I looked at all of the shows that I want to watch and not all of them, but I took a small snapshot of the shows that I'm interested in. And to just give you a small sample here, right? In fact, this isn't the shows that I'm interested in. This is just some of the top 20 streaming shows in Australia today, right now. Yep. So The Bear, Reacher, Slow Horses, Beacon 23, Game of Thrones, Ted Lasso, The Last of Us, Breaking Bad, Banshee, Doctor Who, Only Murders in the Building, Star Trek Discovery, Peaky Blinders, Handmaid's Tale, Westworld, and Stranger Things. Now,
they're not on Netflix.
Some of them are.
Are they? But not all of them.
A couple of them are. The majority are not. Most of those are not on Netflix.
Yeah.
The only ones that are on Netflix are Peaky Blinders, which actually I don't like. I don't dislike it. I didn't get into it. And Stranger Things. Everything else is on a different service. So I worked out that if I wanted all of these shows, I would have to have Apple TV Plus, Binge, Disney Plus, Foxtel Now, Netflix, Paramount Plus, Prime Video, and Stan, and that would cost me $107 a month. What does that remind you of?
Yeah, exactly. I see, yeah. Now, interesting you bring this up, and I haven't looked too far into this, but there is a very new product, particularly here in Australia, that is designed to aggregate your subscription accounts under one banner.
Yeah.
You heard of that one?
I have, because some of the subscription services here are now forcing you to use that to subscribe to them.
So it's called Hubble. And I know because we subscribe to KO, which is the sports package. And I think they are now owned by Hubble.
And you know who owns Hubble?
No.
Foxtel.
There you go.
I personally envisaged that the way that this would go would be that aggregators would pop up and they would say, you know, pay us for a subscription and we'll give you content from all these services.
Yep.
What Hubble do is interesting and it's kind of a step towards that. But what they do is I think you get a discount for every four services that you subscribe to.
Yep.
So you still have to subscribe to these services. You still have to pay for them. But then for every fourth one, you get like $10 off a month or something like that. I don't know the exact details.
Yeah.
So it's not that great. The other way I see it going is that people are going to continue doing what you're doing and what I said I'm doing, which is, okay, so the new season of Stranger Things is out. I'm going to subscribe to Netflix for a month. Next month, I'm going to subscribe to Apple TV Plus. And then the month after that, I'll subscribe to Stan, what have you.
There's an alternative.
Okay.
There is an alternative for that, which is what we alluded to earlier and you said you're going to loop back to.
And this is the second loop back to that, right? And
correct.
I said earlier on that when Netflix came along, statistics for piracy dropped and showed that piracy dropped.
Mm-hmm.
Well, over the past few years, as Netflix has been locking down their sharing and as all these other streaming services has come up, piracy has skyrocketed again.
And it goes back to that point that if there is a more convenient way to get your hands on that content, people will choose that convenient way. People don't want to go out of their way to pirate content, right?
Yep.
But when you make it that hard for us, we're going to do it. Honestly, I don't get enough value out of movies ourselves. We probably don't get enough value out of our Netflix accounts anyway, but it's just there. So I'm not one. I've never really gone out of my way to download illegally or legally movies because I generally don't find myself wanting to watch a movie that desperately that I need to go ahead and do that. I think one of the other things I've noticed with the Netflix original content too is there is so much of it there that that is now all that is there to actually watch.
That's absolutely right. Because all of their suppliers don't want to supply via Netflix anymore. They want to distribute via their own channels.
Which comes back to that point about licensing, right? Now, Paramount won't give the streaming licenses or won't sell streaming licenses to anyone because they've got their own services to use.
Exactly, yeah.
All of a sudden, now we end up with a Netflix subscription that is purely Netflix content.
That's right. That is where we are. And I mentioned earlier about 10 years ago, we all looked at Netflix and we saw them as the disruptor and they were coming along and changing the model of the incumbent, which was the cable and satellite companies. And now I just mentioned a couple of minutes ago about all the different services you need and it costs $107 a month. The disruptor has become the thing that it came to disrupt.
Yeah.
I said that I saw this going one of two ways. And one of those ways was the aggregator approach that we mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The other way is that it may be the case that subscriptions just go away or become very, very cheap. And instead, you wouldn't pay, you know, a monthly subscription to Netflix. You would buy a season pass for the next season of Stranger Things.
So then we're going back to the DVD rental model or the box set rental model.
Yeah, going back to the rental model, but the rental content distributed digitally.
Mm.
And I think that's potentially where it will go.
And I mean, there are services out there where you can rent a movie for 24 hours or whatever it is, 48 hours.
Yeah, they're not great. They're quite expensive for what they are. And plus there's that 48 hours, 24 hours thing. I think what will happen is you'll pay for season 6 of Stranger Things, whatever it's going to be, and then you'll have access to that for as long as they decide to keep it on their platform or until you've watched it, as opposed to time limited.
Yeah. So that's an interest going back to until they want to keep it on their platform, because that analogy is very similar to going out and buying a DVD, right? You own that physical DVD. You own the rights, the license to actually show that in your house whenever you want. But the point you added there was until they don't want to have that on their platform anymore. Like, that's where those two analogies differ. And if that's the case, then I'd rather go out to the shops and buy a physical DVD that I own and no one can take that away from me.
Yeah, but this is not the approach that these companies want. And it's not just Netflix and the movie and TV companies. In the last couple of months, I can't remember who it was, but it was an executive at one of the major gaming companies, almost certainly EA. And I'm probably shaming them unnecessarily, but I would be very surprised if it wasn't them. Said that gamers need to get comfortable with the idea of not owning games because the whole world is moving to this subscription-based approach where you don't own anything. You just pay to access things that you want to access.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the SaaS model, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm not sure if you're familiar there. Back under that SaaS model, and I don't know how we've gotten to this point from Netflix, but bear with me. You familiar with the company 37 Signals? They write Basecamp, right? They've made all their money in the SaaS model, but they're now backflipping and releasing some applications as a one-time purchase payment to run on your own bare metal. Because they're looking at it saying, okay, well, there's a lot of wasted money on paying for your SaaS subscriptions month on month. And they themselves have found benefits by bringing things in-house.
Yeah, I remember that blog post. That was huge.
Yeah. So now they're releasing products, source code and all, and saying, okay, well, you buy the license, you run it on your bare metal, and we're going back, what was it, 10, 20 years, back to that old model of you've got the license, you run the application.
It's interesting that they're doing that. There's definitely a backlash against this idea that we as consumers don't own what we buy. People don't like this idea. I mentioned that gaming executive. Obviously, that comment didn't go well, and there was a big backlash against it. Companies like 37 Signals and releasing software like this, yeah, you know, maybe that's part of that movement to say, no, we do want to own what we buy. But it's interesting because I think software is a different beast, and it's an interesting contrast example. And the reason I say that is that if you think back to when we used to buy software to own it, so, you know, Office 95, right? Yeah. If I bought Office 95, 2 years later, I could buy Office 97 if I wanted to, but really, I would be buying it because it looks a bit schmicker. It probably doesn't have more in the way of features. Once they switch from the Doc to the DocX format, it doesn't have anything different in terms of compatibility. But now, things are different. And the reason things are different now is because we get security updates. What SaaS does is, through a subscription, takes away that problem of having to continually upgrade your software. And before SaaS, I mean, I was talking about Office 95, but in the enterprise software space, if you bought some enterprise software from someone, you would pay the license and you would own it, and then you would pay a maintenance fee. And that maintenance fee was usually 10 or 20% of the license cost that you would pay to the vendor every year. And in exchange for that maintenance fee, you would never have to buy the software again, but you'd get access to those updates. Now, in an enterprise application, that's not just it looking schmicker, and it's not just security updates, but that usually is new features, and that's usually new features that you probably have requested or want. You know, if you're requesting them, you're probably paying for bespoke development. But if you compare that to Netflix and you compare that to subscriptions with probably not games, because games do release updates, but with content, like, you know, like you said, the difference between owning and buying a DVD, you don't have to worry about maintenance. You don't have to worry about updates. You know, it's not like, well, with the exception of George Lucas, it's not like you're going to get, you know, patches to the movie with new CGI every year. It's a different model, right? And, you know, I think it makes more sense for software for you to pay a subscription than it does for entertainment content.
Yes, I think so. I think I can kind of agree there. But at the same time, as a consumer, I wouldn't be going out buying dozens of movies, even in a year, right? I'm not going to buy a dozen movies a year, maybe not even in the next 5 years. We personally don't watch movies enough to be going out and buying them. But spending an equivalent amount per year on a subscription, it's a different switch in the brain. And I'd probably end up consuming the same amount of content that I would never have gone out of my way to buy.
Yeah. But with the subscription for Netflix or whichever service, you're not just paying for the content, you're paying for the convenience of having it on demand.
Yes, exactly. But as we've just alluded to, or as we've just uncovered, that convenience is slowly disappearing.
Eroding.
Eroding. Yeah. That's the word.
So yeah, so that brings us to where we are now. And where we are now is that the disruptor, as I said, has become the very thing that it sought to disrupt. Consumers are no longer in that utopia. I don't know where it's going. You know, we know that piracy is on the rise. We know that there's a backlash against subscriptions and people wanting to buy and own content. We know that people are subscription hopping from one month to the next. Where's this going to go a long time? I don't know, but it's interesting to see. And I think the most interesting thing that's happened is that the model that we have now, which is basically software-based as opposed to, you know, billion-dollar satellites in space and, you know, costly cables and dishes and equipment and all that, means that disruptors can come along and disrupt very quickly now. So maybe things will change.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you just said, we're moving away from the technical constraints, right? And now it's business innovation, not technical innovation.
Absolutely. So what do you think? Do you think Netflix shot themselves in the foot with their Netflix original content, or do you think that was a smart move?
I think the results that we're seeing were inevitable regardless of whether or not Netflix started doing their original content.
Yeah, I agree. And I've been a bit disingenuous because obviously all of the major content creators and studios were sniffing around the idea of launching their own streaming services before Netflix started doing their own original content in a big way.
Exactly. They would have seen the convenience and the market that they could have addressed by having their own services. So like I said, I think it was inevitable. I find it disappointing as a consumer that we don't have access to that broad spectrum of content that we did have access to. Because like we said before, you know, you jump onto Netflix as the Netflix original, or you go onto Stan, that's Stan exclusive, right? But it's all stuff that's, you're only getting their own content now.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of those things that as a consumer, I'm going to have to adapt to. Again, I keep saying it, in our household, we don't value TV as much as other households do, TV content.
Yeah.
So chances are we're going to drop, I think where we'd stand at the moment, we're going to drop that when we've got nothing else that we want to watch. We're bored of that. And we'll find something else and we'll move on to the next one. And something else pops up. Like you alluded to earlier, maybe we'll wait for Netflix to build up a small cache of content that we have not seen yet and we'll transfer across and then find another one after that.
Yeah. So I think that subscription hopping is the new normal. And I think, you know, I said it can go a number of ways, and that kind of is the way that it has gone and is the way it is now. Whether it continues remains to be seen. But that is kind of basically what most people are doing now. I think very few people are just like, well, I've got Netflix and that's what I've got and that's what I watch. Now, the next thing that Netflix can do, and maybe I shouldn't be saying this on the podcast because I'd be giving them ideas, but I'd be surprised if they're not already planning this. Now, what you just said is that
they're not already listening.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You just said what you might do is wait for them to have a cache of things that you want to watch and then subscribe for a month, 2 months and get through them. It wouldn't surprise me if Netflix go down the road of, okay, Stranger Things is out this month. It will be on Netflix for August and then we're taking it off. Next month, we'll have this other show and then we're taking it off.
They would have the metrics. They would have all the ratings data, everything they need to do to understand exactly what people want to watch, when they want to watch it, and how to release it. They'll understand that. You would agree that we don't actually understand ourselves. One more point I wanted to bring up too, back to your point about subscription hopping being the new normal. I think you'll find that the services themselves have recognized this. If you recall, Netflix and a few others used to have 1 month free that you can cancel within that first month. Now they make you pay for the first month, but they give you a higher package as an incentive to sign up. But you still have to pay something for that first month.
I think you still get 7 days free, but that's will discount your first month by seven days.
So, but either way, they make you actually pay and stump up front because they knew people were exactly as you were saying. The new normal is subscription hopping.
Yeah. Now, if you compare that to cable and satellite, where you can't do that because they've got to install equipment and hardware and maintain a satellite or cable. So there was no 1 month contract. It was 12 months, 24 months. Mm-hmm. And that was your commitment.
Yeah.
But with the digital distribution, again, that's the main disruptor, is that you can subscription hop. And as I said, that's the new normal. And I said that the other option was that you would pay a season pass for whatever show you want to watch. But really, they're equivalent. It really amounts to the same thing. You know, this season of this show is on this subscription service. So I'll subscribe to it for this month and watch that thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What we've lost is a little bit of convenience, because it just means that from 1 month to the next, you've got to think, do I cancel this month and switch to something else?
And again, that's the SaaS model, right? We'll get an extra month out of you because you missed your cancellation date. So we'll get an extra month. Unless you're Adobe and you charge people through the nose for an early cancellation fee.
And install a virus on their computer that can never be removed.
I think that's a topic for another day.
Yeah, indeed. And on that bombshell, you know what my observation is, Liam, of all this?
What's that?
It's a tenuous analogy, but just to make the point for the third time about the disruptors becoming the very thing that they sought to disrupt.
Mm-hmm.
The analogy that I'm thinking of is the house always wins.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like you said, the main aggregator here in Australia is owned by the cable company.
The main incumbent.
The main incumbent cable company that was disrupted by Netflix.
Consumers had it good for a while, but the house always wins.
That's it. So with that, Matt, I think it's time to move on to your beverages.
Indeed, yeah.
So what were you doing tonight?
I've seen you've been sipping what looks like a nice red. Were you inspired by our chat with Nick Randolph?
Yeah, I was. I realized I've been on the Young Henrys week in, week out, and I thought this week I'm going to have a bit of a change. So I cracked open a Shiraz from the Hunter Valley.
Nice.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite wineries, small winery up there. They're actually quite a lot larger than they were when we first went up, but a winery up in the Hunter Valley called Glandor.
Mm-hmm.
I've been a member there now for probably over 10 years, and they've just gone from strength to strength and reasonably priced, good tasting wines.
Nice. I have a favorite winery in the Hunter as well. They're called Oakvale, that I've mentioned to you before, and I have a case of their Shiraz that I need to get through as well, so I'll probably be drinking that next time. But this evening I have been drinking what was probably too large a glass of Aldi Scotch.
Nah, no such thing as too large a glass.
Probably not. It was a long day.
I can only imagine. And what's today? Today's Tuesday.
No, it's Friday, mate. It's definitely Friday.
Trust me, it certainly feels like it. But yes, hopefully there's the rest of the week is not as challenging as it has been so far.
Fingers crossed, there's more scotch in the bottle if it is. I know how to deal with my problems in a healthy manner.
look, better than me. To deal with my problems, I'll either go for a 3-hour, 4-hour run in the national park and try to get lost, or lock myself in the garage and put a brew of beer on and get lost. I don't know which way is the healthiest way.
You know, we've spoken about this before, but I'm not into the long distance running that much anymore. But every time I go for a run and I finish and you know, it's like 35 minutes, 30 minutes, I just think, I wish it was longer. So I think I'm probably going to start getting into some longer runs again.
Yeah, I'm falling apart. I think this is my last big stint.
Yeah, you know, I'm not talking about doing ultras or anything, but I'm, you know, maybe 10, 20 Ks rather than, you know, five. Yep.
You know, you got it in you. You can do it.
Yeah. I always used to say, I've probably said this before on here, but I always used to say that I think a half marathon is the limit of a distance you can run and actually enjoy. Because I can run a half marathon and enjoy it. But once you push past, yes, really, actually 18 kilometers, really, I find is that kind of threshold. Then you just do those last three. But after that, there's no enjoyment in it. It's something that you're doing because you're pushing yourself and it's pain. And yeah, like it's rewarding in its way, but it's not. Less than that, you can actually enjoy, I find.
I think there's a lot to it, right? Especially from my perspective. I completely agree. A half marathon, it's a good challenging distance where you can push yourself but still enjoy it. Marathon distance is torture, particularly if we're talking on the road. If you're talking marathon distance out in the bush, that's a different story for me. I find that quite enjoyable and I really, really love doing that. However, this is, I think there's a psychology to it here. And when you're doing a race, particularly a race, no matter what the distance is, it's the last 4 to 5 kilometers that is purely brutal. And the closer you get to the end, it just gets even worse because you're just like, I want this thing to finish. I'm in a lot of pain now. I can't, this just needs to finish. In my experience, right, I've just recently, a couple of weeks back, did the 6 foot track, which is 45 kilometers. And the last 2 or 3 kilometers, absolutely in a lot of pain. I've pushed myself. I just want to finish. And you get to the finish line. The finish line at the moment, it's kind of deceptive and there's a little bit more. And even that last 100 meters where you're expecting it to finish, but then someone's gone, I know we're going to throw in an extra 100 meters that you didn't quite see until you start to approach it and they push the finish line out further. It's brutal. But at the same time, I'm also going to be running more than twice that distance. And I'll guarantee you, when I hit the 45K mark in my upcoming run, I won't be in as bad a position as I was at the end of the 6 foot track, 45Ks. Purely, it's a psychological thing, right? Because you know the end is so close, yet so far, that's what hurts. That's the pain.
Yeah. Well, when I was doing marathons, they always used to say that 30 kilometers is the halfway mark, right? Because that last 12 is easily half the effort. But ever since I did my first race, I don't know why I did it the first time, but I always did it every time since, was I would sprint the finishing chute. So when you get to that 100 meters until you see the finish line, I would sprint. And I would find something, I would dig deep, I'd find something, and just the excitement of just getting over that finishing line until I did the Ironman.
Yeah, keep going. I've got stuff to add to this, but keep going.
Yeah, you know, I had it in my mind that I was going to have a real strong finish and triumphantly sprint over that finish line, even the last like 20 meters. I think it's 50 meters, the finishing chute on that one that I did. Anyway, I limped it.
So
that was the best I could do. I'm just glad I didn't
crawl. No one would have begrudged you for crawling across that line.
Yeah.
I used to, before my kids started getting so big, I used to love carrying them across the finish line. Even when you're completely gassed and your legs are about to collapse, I'd always find enough energy to be able to pick my kids up and run across the line with them. These days, now that they're a bit heavier, it's a lot harder. But back to your point, one of my training partners recently, he was saying too, when I used to train with him a long time ago and I've trained with him more recently, he used to always finish strong, right? Even on training runs, you'd be out there and the last kilometer, last 1.5 kilometers, he would just start sprinting and you'd have to sprint to catch up. And his philosophy was based off a coach that was coaching him. It was basically just saying, leave nothing in the bag. On race day, there's absolutely no reason to leave anything in the bag. And so when you think about it that way, it's not so much I am sprinting across the finish line or I'm sprinting that last 50 meters. It's I am giving it 100% to make sure that when I cross that finish line, I have 0% left. So when you say that you stumbled across the line on the Ironman, you didn't have to give 110% at that point. You just had to make sure you had nothing left.
Yeah, I had nothing left.
Don't blame you.
Yeah.
So Matt, I think on that, that's the end of this week's episode of The Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman. Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.